Thanks a lot, Andy.
Today I'm going to discuss processes and mechanisms that contribute to the shape of the fly wing. And this is work done in Dresden in collaboration with a group of Suzanne Eaton. Suzanne has already been here at the beginning of this program and has given a talk outlining these projects. So I will today focus a little bit more on some of the theoretical approaches that we've developed to address these fundamental questions in this model system. So I think my talk will be somewhat complementary to what Suzanne presented, but there will be also a little bit of overlap. So the fundamental question we are interested in is to understand what processes contribute to shaping the wing of a fly. Here you see the characteristic shape of an adult fly wing. And below, for comparison, the wing of a fly that is mutant in a single gene called Dumpy, which is associated with the extracellular matrix. And this mutation, a single gene mutation, gives rise to an abnormal shape of the wing. And I'm going to discuss processes and mechanisms that in the pupal stage of development contribute to shaping the wing and are also related to the difference between these two phenotypes. And the advantage of looking at the pupal phase of developing is that it is now easy to observe this process in vivo by opening the pupal case and directly observing the tissue inside the pupal case as it undergoes a dramatic remodeling. And so I just show you here what this looks like. So this is wing tissue in the pupa about 16 hours after pupillary formation. There is a E-cadherin staining, so that in the fluorescence microscope one can see the outlines of the individual cells. And by taking images every 5 minutes over a course of overall 17 hours, one can observe this tissue remodeling in the living system. And one can see in this process, which is very dynamic, that cells flow, move in this tissue, rearrange. There is a large number of cell divisions taking place. One can see that when cells divide, they round up and get these spherical dark shapes. Cells change their area, patterns emerge, the vein structures emerge, and the characteristic morphology of a fly wing emerges during this time. We can also notice that the whole tissue is deformed, there are shear flows, and the margin shows a movement and shape change, which we're going to discuss in the following.
Does it only seem like most of the divisions are in the vein region?
I think it only seems like that, so we have exact data on that. But since the vein cells are smaller, it's difficult to compare by eye with these rates. But there are waves of divisions which start in the intervein regions, as far as I remember.
There's the histoblasts and marble epidermis right underneath.
I'm not even sure exactly what. So what I'm going to discuss in the following is first the question, how do these large-scale tissue deformations, which change the shape of this tissue, emerge from large numbers of seemingly random cellular processes, such as cell rearrangement, cell shape changes, and cell divisions? And having sort of an idea about this geometry of remodeling of this tissue, we try to address the question, what kind of mechanics takes place? What are the mechanical conditions that generate flows and deformations in this tissue? So what are the forces and the force balances that underlie cell flows and tissue remodeling? And here are some recent references in which you find many of the most of what I'm describing this talk. Now, just first to give you a very large scale point of view, which helps you later to understand when I zoom in to the system, let me just show you the dynamic process in a very coarse-grained picture. This is the adult wing that emerges out of the pupa in the end. This is called the hinge region, and this is called the blade. And in the early tissue, what will become the hinge is labeled in blue here, and what will become the blade is labeled in red. And you see that there's a big transformation going on. And a dominant process is that the wing hinge contracts in area as this tissue is remodeled and deformed. And sort of this contracting area actually also acts as a force generator that pulls on the blade tissue and contributes to its deformation. So very simplified, but just as a starting point to help you think about this problem when you look at these movies, think of the tissue as being attached at the margins to a rigid cuticle, which was secreted earlier. And now as this tissue undergoes remodeling and deformations, and in particular as the hinge contracts, while this tissue is attached at the margins, it contracts and therefore pulls itself. It creates forces by contracting that act on the margin, and so it is stretched in this process. So we get a shear deformation. So this blade tissue gets stretched, while if it's shearing, also narrows. And so here I just put forward the idea that there is a mechanical connection keeping the tissue in some sort of a rigid frame. And this can be sort of shown experimentally by using a laser ablation near the margin of the tissue in regions outside the tissue, of cutting or ablating the extracellular matrix material that links the tissue to the cuticle. Now in this case, along this blue line, such a laser ablation was induced at about 22 hours after puparic formation, and looking at this tissue at 32 hours, it has retracted from this margin, suggesting that if the margin is not ablated, it is sort of kept there by mechanical connections. Similarly, ablating on the side tissue moves inwards if it is free to move.
When you say extracellular cuticle,
do you mean the larval cuticle? There's a cuticle surrounding the wing tissue.
I see. And so you're separating the connection between that cuticle, which is extruded by the exterior of those cells, and the underlying cells.
Yeah, so the tissue at earlier times secretes this cuticle and detaches from it and forms inside this this bag, the wing tissue. That's what I'm talking about.
But remains attached to it.
It remains attached to it. And here it's separate, exactly. So therefore, sort of a very simplified question.
So just still trying to understand the picture of that sort of boundary edge. So that doesn't change during its process of retraction.
During the process that we are looking at here, we have these connections at the margin to the cuticle.
But
only if I wear a blade, we can perturb this.
Yeah. But so the blade tissue is hooked up to the cuticle, and the muscle tissue is also hooked up to the cuticle.
I think there's connections everywhere, yes.
But, if you're a little... so elastic linker, very good.
So that's what I come to now.
Okay, maybe I'll wait till you explain. Yeah.
So that's sort of a cartoon picture of what I'm saying. The tissue, so at the end of my talk, I will distinguish the blade and the hinge region as somehow behaving differently. And sort of a very crude picture of what I'm saying here is that this wing tissue with hinge and blade is sort of sitting inside a rigid frame and is connected with elastic linkers around it. And the elastic linkers are this polymeric extracellular matrix material which sits between the margin and the cuticle. And that will
be my question in a way refers to those red linkers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because in your,
so they,
your
they
previous,
exist.
In your previous cartoon, there were conveniently no boundary conditions.
In the calculations I'm doing there, the cartoon was just there to illustrate the idea that if you stretch, if you contract, you pull on the lattices of the wing
and
plate.
And I'm just trying to reconcile.
So there are elastic linkers all around the tissue, on all sides. Here I put them in sort of rigidly, just for simplification here in this drawing. But there are elastic linkers all around. That's the picture. Okay, now so this is a sort of a global picture with of the whole process. And let's now zoom into the system. And let's ask, what do the cells do in this process? And in order to address that, we are using image analysis to determine the shapes of all the individual cells in this tissue. And here you see such a segmentation of one image, so we can track the positions and shapes of all the cells, of the order of 10,000 cells here. And we can do that frame to frame and track cells, see when they divide, see when they rearrange, and keep the shapes of all the individual cells during the whole process with a certain small number of segmentation errors, which are hard to avoid. Now, to illustrate the high resolution of this data, you should remember that taking one of these images involves a larger number of microscope images which are stitched together. So we have a high resolution of the system. So if you zoom in, we can sort of here see the fluorescence from individual cells. This is the segmentation. And we can identify cells and give them a unique label. So these are these numbers you see here. And we can track them from frame to frame. We can see when cellular rearrangements occur, or when cellular events happen. For example, this cell is going to divide in the next frame, or it looks a little bit bigger than the others. And after these 5 minutes, there are now two daughters which get new labels. And in this process, we can sort of see how all these cells then rearrange. So this gives us now the geometry of cells in this whole process for 17 hours with the polygonal shape of the individual cells. And starting from this polygonal meshwork of the cells in this tissue, we construct a conjugate triangular network. Let's illustrate this here. So we start from polygons. We define geometric cell centers. And so corresponding to each vertex with three neighboring cells, we can now define a triangle connecting these three cell centers. Now, the conjugate triangular network contains essentially the same information as the original polygonal one. Of course, we can have access to both networks if we need to. But using the triangulation has a number of advantages, which I'm going to explain following. So now we have either the whole set of polygons and the polygonal network as a function of time, or the full set of triangles and the triangulation as a function of time, defining the tissue remodeling. Now, we using quantification of various interesting measures of deformations, shapes, and so on in these networks. Let me first introduce the measure of deformations that we use. So in continuum mechanics, deformations are characterized by displacement gradients. And now we would like to have this concept for our tissue, but with a discrete structure of a polygonal or triangular nature. And the idea is that one can define a locally averaged displacement gradient, which is a tensorial object. So the derivative is a vector 1 index, and u is the displacement vector with a component beta, averaged over a certain region of space. This is an average displacement gradient, which can be, for example, defined for a single cell, can be defined for a group of cells, or it can be defined for the whole tissue, depending on which range we do the integration. And because it's a derivative, this can be also expressed in a boundary integral, the same quantity. Using the normal along the boundary of a region and the displacement only of the boundary. So it's enough to know the displacement of the boundary of a given region to calculate this quantity by integrating around the contour. Now, this boundary integral I can also use for a triangle, which I deform, and therefore define the displacement gradient for a single triangle. And by averaging now the single triangle, or if you want single cell, whatever scale I want to look at, with an area-weighted manner over a certain region, I calculate exactly the same quantity that I would have gotten if I would integrate around a bigger region, the boundary deformation. So that's just a very elegant and useful way to define displacement tensors, coarse-grained displacement gradient tensors on many different scales. And on the large scales, this becomes identical to the coarse-grained continuum mechanical definition.
This is displacement with respect to what?
This is displacement respect to initial reference state. So you have one image which defines positions, and then we ask how these positions are displaced from one image to the next.
To the next,
yeah. And we'll come to issues that are related to remodeling of the tissue in this process. So in the simple case where cells keep all the neighborships from one image to the next, this is all completely straightforward, and when neighborships changes, the reference to define displacement changes in the process. Okay, now this tensor U alpha beta is a 2x2 matrix. As a gradient of a vector, it is in general has no specific symmetry properties, but one can decompose it in different contributions. As a very general decomposition of tensors, I can first take away the antisymmetric part of this matrix. It's proportional to epsilon, which is a totally antisymmetric 2x2 matrix, with a strength psi. And this psi is now a rotation angle that defines how this volume element is rotating. If I look at the trace of this matrix, this tells me how areas change. It corresponds to the divergence of this vector. And what remains is the traceless symmetric part, which is a tensor that defines an axis in strength and defines the shear deformation that this piece of element undergoes along an axis defined by this matrix. So we have decomposition in these essential components, which will be important. Following, and the tilde always denotes the traceless contribution, which is pure shear. Rotations are taken out. Now, when we go from one frame to the next, we can now define if we can define displacements. And if we also have the time interval, we can have velocities. And now, if you're using the so-defined deformation tensor and divided by time, this then defines a velocity gradient tensor, which is sort of corresponds to the continuum mechanical shear tensor that one has in fluids, for example. And again, this one we can decompose in the same way as before, and now the traceless symmetric part is not a pure shear rate with a certain axis. The divergence of the flow is the expansion rate, and the antisymmetric part is now a rotation rate, a local vorticity, which can be defined like this.
What does vorticity mean here?
So if you have a fluid with a vorticity and you put an object in it, it would rotate, it would spin in the fluid, carried by the vortex in the fluid.
Okay. The degree to which it will do this is the vorticity.
The rate, in this case, the way it's defined is it's an angular rotation rate, angle change per unit time. And here you see sort of this velocity field calculated for the movie, but coarse grains, so velocity vectors defined by averaging on small regions of the tissue, so that we have put them here in this mesh just to make it easier visible here. Okay, so that's the definition of tissue deformations, which are by this procedure defined at all different scales, including for individual cells or individual triangles, if you want to. Now, a second set of important quantities that we measure has to do with shape. And in contrast to the deformation measures, which are which tell you how a system is deformed when going from one image to the next, the shape measures are a property of a state of a given image. So one can define it on a single image, and it's a state property independent of the history of how one went to the state. Well, deformations is something which depends on how one moves from one state to the next. These quantities, shape quantities, are state properties independent of history. And this is where the triangles become important, because the triangles, this can be done very elegantly. So any triangle, any possible triangle, can be uniquely and precisely in its shape, the shape of a triangle can be defined by two objects: a traceless symmetric tensor, which we call elongation tensor, and an orientation angle. And the idea is the following. These two objects define an affine transformation which generates a given triangle of interest starting from an equilateral triangle, which is a reference. And this affine transformation is written here. So the angle theta enters in a rotation matrix, which means first, when we apply this transformation to an equilateral reference triangle, we are just rotating the reference triangle. So theta is the orientation of the reference triangle. And then this transformation is multiplied with exponential of this matrix Q, which essentially now stretches the reference triangle along a given axis and makes a non-equilateral triangle out of it. I should note that the rotation matrix obviously doesn't change the area of the triangle. And since Q has trace 0, exponential of Q is determinant 1, and therefore this also doesn't change the area of the triangle. So this is a transformation which preserves area, only changes shape. And every triangle can be uniquely written like this. It has exactly the number of parameters to define all possible triangle shapes.
It's odd position, right? Because, I mean, you could rotate in one direction. So, ends of the triangle, points of the triangle defined at the next time point? Because you could think of different rotations.
So this is at a given time point. We come to dynamics later. This is, if I see a triangle in an image, I can calculate for this triangle Q and theta, and they are well defined.
And they are unique.
They're unique, yes. Yeah. And so, and if I know the Qs and thetas of all the triangles, I know all their shapes, and I can essentially reconstruct the whole network from the set of these values.
But it's not the unicity the unicity is weird to me.
What do you mean by weird to you?
I could find different ways
I'm just saying that this gives you all possible triangles, and the area is not changed. So this has it changes all triangles with the same area as the original one. Okay. If you want to take area change into account, I have to scale it.
Yeah, sure.
In addition, so this then generates all possible triangles, even with different areas.
The question is the left link of the vertex.
Yeah, exactly.
So you have an ambiguity on the left link of the vertex.
Yes. Which, if you go into these questions, it means that theta is not periodic in 2 pi, but in 2 pi over 3.
Okay. Yes. So along the same lines, so the slight quibble over the use of words, which I've already observed here in the past 2 weeks, causes some confusion. So calling this elongation tensor makes some people think that something necessarily is getting longer, right? But it doesn't have to get longer. You're just describing a shape. So
yes.
I can produce your elongated shape just as well by compressing in the other direction.
Yes.
And I've heard people start argue whether elongation describes something getting longer or compressing something.
Yeah.
This just describes shape, and one way to avoid this confusion would have been to call it a deformation tensor.
No, deformation tensor is this one here. That's a deformation tensor. I can't call it a deformation tensor. Because this deformation tensor is not a state property. But we'll come to the relationship between those two, which is very interesting and subtle. But it's also not a strain tensor, no. But I can give you a hint here. That is, the elongation tensor defines an axis. And along this axis, the object is longer as compared to the particular one. And it is a shape quantity. So the point is, it's about shape, but it's not about deformation. But if elongation is So I think of the word elongation as a property, not as a deformation. Yeah? So if something has a big elongation, it is very elongated.
You don't have to explain
it. It's very elongated. But I'm using your point to clarify this issue. So the meaning of the word is if something has a big elongation, it is elongated as a state property. So Q is a traceless symmetric tensor, which is a state property. That's really important. And one can sort of think of it as an axis with some strength. So I draw it here as a little red bar. So if it has a cell of such a shape, then the elongation tensor would define such an axis. And the more the cell is sort of stretched in this way and narrow in this way as if it has a shape property, the longer this red bar would be.
Sort of back at the beginning naively, why have you created this triangulation network instead of dealing with the polygons? Because the polygons are so chaotic, all different.
Yeah, the polygons, I guess, doing what I'm describing now with the polygons is just not unique and more complicated. Because I can use these to define exactly a triangle. If I want to describe a polygon, I need more parameters than that.
Okay.
And now also the number of parameters I need depends on how many edges the polygon has.
Right, which is also changing.
And then I get a more messy formalism.
Yes.
Yeah, one more question. Yeah. So you say you define this per cell, no? So it means the average...
Or per triangle, as you want. Yeah. So if I define it per triangle, I can then define it per cell by averaging over those triangles that belong to a cell.
So it's part of one cell, but also only part of another cell.
I can... Since it's only a shape property, it's true that if I do it like I draw here, it also has some properties of the neighboring cells. If I would have only one cell property, I would have to redefine my triangles by using the cell bonds. But that doesn't change the mathematics I'm going to describe. It's just the way.
You have to put some, define your triangulation differently.
I could also use a triangulation that goes from the bonds to the center and make more triangles per cell. Okay. Then I have exactly something which. But it's a bit more complicated. It's not really necessary. But I have a lot of freedom to do things if I want to get a certain thing exact in such a way.
Does the tissue have this shape at some point, such that most of the triangles are equilateral? Or?
If you have a hexagonal network, all of the triangles are equilateral, but that's a special case. And of course, at the end, the tissue has many triangles looking almost hexagonal, but this is a special case. In general, the triangles are rarely equilateral.
But it's very tensile in adults.
In the case of the wing, it's almost hexagonal,
right.
So there we are not far from what she suggested. But it's a very special case in some sense because one special tissue which does that.
So you know, Matt Gibson had this suggestion a few years ago that there was some kind of potential universality to neighbor numbers, polygon sides across epithelia. I mean, they were generalizing from three animals, but you think that again they were looking at a kind of special case of epithelia?
I think different epithelia have slightly different properties in this
right.
in this respect, but it's an interesting question, this universality, but it's not part of my talk, so let's discuss it separately. Okay, so now I can define Q for any small patch of triangles, or cells, for regions of cells, by averaging these matrices. And this gives me then an idea about what is the typical shape of cells in a certain region of the tissue.
Side point here. When you average, you take into account the size of the triangle.
I think in the case of Q, I have to look it up again. Maybe using an area average, but not 100% sure. I have to check that. So like I did in the case of the deformation tensor, we're using the same area average everywhere.
When you have T4 junction, a vertex with 4 junction radiating, how will you then draw your triangles?
I'll come to that. So let me first just show you what this quantification looks like for this fly by coarse grading of little rectangles that correspond to this lattice of red bars that you see here. And each red bar defines the tensor that is averaged in a certain small region. And you see, it starts out sort of quite irregular, and now suddenly a large-scale pattern of cell shape emerges, with cells typically having shapes that have a long axis along the long axis of the wing. And there's a large-scale organization of this pattern. And you will see also that this builds up in the middle of the process. It is a maximum about now here, and then it relaxes again. And we'll come to discuss this later. So this is now, here I show you how this shape measure evolves in time. And now I've introduced two types of quantification of geometry. One quantification of deformations, which I call deformation tensor, and one quantification of shape, which is the elongation tensor and the angle. And now the question is, what is the relation between those two objects? Yeah.
You seem to adopt here an Eulerian point of view. Is there a reason why did you choose really an Eulerian point of view? Is there a reason why you choose more an Eulerian point of view?
It is just because we have a network of polygons and we can track them. We know the identity of cells. So we, in that sense, I think you can choose here what you do. You can also here flow with cells or not flow with cells, whatever you want.
Sure, but is there a better search?
Depends on the question you're asking, I would say. I guess in most cases we always track patches of cells. And in this case we are keeping the position fixed through which cells flow, but this is, you can do as you want. And we have examples for both. So we don't, it's just that this is easier to show. Okay, now we come to an interesting geometry of these quantities.
So when you average over your patch, how similar are the cell behaviors? So what's the variance in your
field? I don't know it by heart, but the variance can be measured and shown.
It's very dissimilar? Cells are very
At the beginning, when these are sort of irregular, then are very dissimilar. And in particular also in orientation. And when this thing is nicely organized, they're not very dissimilar. They're very similar. But this can be plotted as. I don't have these plots in my slides. Now I'd like to take a little bit of time to go into the geometry of this, because it turns out to be important for the analysis that comes. So we have in two subsequent frames triangles that we can track from front frame to the next. And while we track them, they move, but it is not important for what I'm going to say, but they change their shape. And so the shape change can be characterized by my deformation tensor, which is a shear and a rotation, defined as I did in the first part for deformations. At the same time, I know for the initial triangle its exact state, q theta a, and for the final triangle, I know its state, q theta a. Now the question is, if I know q theta a initially and the changes of these quantities, delta q, delta theta, delta a, What are the contributions to the deformation tensor? In the case of the expansion, the isotropic part is very easy. It just has to do with the area change. What is more subtle is to express these two quantities in terms of delta q, delta theta, delta a. But because it's just triangle geometry, and that's why we're using triangles, this can be done exactly. It's just writing down the expressions. So one can calculate it straightforward from the definitions that I gave you. And for the shear, the pure shear component of this deformation, we get this expression, which looks, at first glance, complicated. It's non-trivial, but it has some very interesting basic features. First, I'm using a notation where I parameterize the tensor Q, which is symmetric and traceless, by two numbers, a magnitude q and an orientation angle phi. And you see this matrix has no trace. The sum of these two is zero and it's symmetric. Now this number g depends on the strength q. It's here defined here. G is the hyperbolic sine of q divided by q. Delta phi is the change of the orientation of q when going from q to q prime. That's a change in the axis of triangle elongation, going from here to here. And delta theta is a change in the triangle orientation, when going from here to here, defined via the reference triangle. Now you see that the second term, even though it looks complicated, is the original triangle elongation q times a totally antisymmetric epsilon tensor, which in fact is an infinitesimal rotation. So this here is a rotation of Q by some complicated angle. What this shows is that the shear deformation tensor is almost the same as the triangle elongation change of Q, except one has to evaluate this change in a co-rotating reference frame. And in a co-rotating reference frame, these are the same, but only then. Now, in addition, I can also write an expression for the rotational part of the deformation. And this now also depends on the angle change of the triangle and the orientation change of the Q tensor. Now, I should also mention, this here has the property, which is also important, that if I take a triangle and I apply a pure rotation to it, I don't change its shape. And therefore, I don't apply any shear. Now, if I apply a pure rotation, then delta theta and delta phi are the same. Then this complicated term with G drops out. And what remains is that this sort of absorbs the rotation in Q, and delta U is zero. So if we evaluate this for a pure rotation, we find the fact that delta U is zero because there is no shear. Similarly, for the angle change for a pure rotation, we find that delta psi is equals to delta theta, rotation of the triangle. Now this looks, maybe should before I come to this. So let me first point to this idea that I mentioned before. I can now go to time-dependent processes, take a small time interval, and define the rate of change. When I now define the rate of change of U, this defines me the shear part of the velocity gradient tensor of the system. And this now can be written by using this expression as a dQ dt plus a correction term. And it turns out that this correction term is a co-rotational term, which means one has to take the time derivative of Q, the overall term, the time derivative of Q in a reference frame that rotates with the system at a certain angular rate, which is given by what is written here. And another way we usually write that is that what really is observed is the rotation of the tissue, which is the psi dt, and we can define a co-rotational time derivative of the local elongation by having the normal or convected time derivative plus a co-rotational term. And we can also show that this is a sort of a generalized co-rotational time derivative of a tensor. And for the experts, I might mention that in the limit where Q is small, this coincides exactly with the so-called Jaumann derivative that one finds in hydrodynamics of, for example, viscoelastic systems. But this is a little bit more complicated because of this function C, which shows up, and this is just a consequence of the geometry of triangles. Now, this is a little bit, maybe not very much transparent, and therefore I want to give you a sense of what this equations actually describe, because it's very difficult by just looking at them to understand what they mean. It's the property of triangles and the quantities I introduce, but they have an interesting content that I want to show you. And in order to show that, I want to deform not just a triangle because it's harder, sort of, it's too abstract. I'm going to deform a circular object with a pattern on it. In this case, the Minerva. And for this circular object with a pattern, I can define the angular theta as a direction where this head watches. And I can define the tensor Q by elongating the circle, forming the circle, elongating it. And then the long axis of this ellipsoid, which is generated, defines the tensor Q. And now I can demonstrate what happens, what's described by these equations. And there's a particular interesting example that reveals that these equations contain a coupling between shear, elongation, and rotation. That is not trivial. So if I start with an elongated head, and the green is the axis of Q, that's the elongation, which you now see horizontal. And now I start to shear this object in a direction not parallel to the green axis, at in fact 45 degrees. The shear will not change the area, it will deform it. So it will change the ellipse, and in fact it will change the main axis of the ellipse, and it will deform the pattern. And now we do that continuously and change the deform the system only with pure shear, always changing the axis of the shear, always making sure that there's no rotational component in the deformation, delta psi equals zero, rotating, therefore, the axis of Q. And when we do that, we actually find that the pattern rotates. I show you that in an animation. But this is our initially stretched pattern. Q is in this axis. We now shear along this axis and therefore change the shape of the whole outline, but also deform the pattern. And as we now rotate the axis of elongation by applying shear in different directions, even though at no time there is any rotation applied, only shear in different directions, the pattern rotates. And this is a non-trivial feature of the combination of elongation, shear, and rotations, which is exactly the sort of the non-trivial content of these two equations. And of course, there are many cases where these equations are very simple and intuitive, but in this particular case, you see that they have a non-intuitive or non-trivial content. So the simple picture is to say, if we know Q in the beginning or at the end, we can calculate shear by knowing the changes of Q from one frame to the next, but we have to evaluate it in the co-moving, co-rotating reference frame. And in the continuum approach, we have to introduce a co-rotational time derivative, which takes a time derivative in a reference frame that turns as the system rotates. Okay, so that's a geometrical background that enters a dynamic model of the geometry of polygonal or triangular networks. Now let's come back to the experimental data.
Yes. When you first defined the deformation tensor, yeah, you pointed out that you could express that with a component called vorticity, which has
the rate of change. Rate of change. Yeah.
Yes, and so that's a change that's given us a rate of change that's change of angle with time.
Yes.
How is that related to this? How is that related to this rotation of the pattern?
Vorticity is always zero. It's surprising. That's what it is. So you can actually see the from these equations. And in fact, my student made this movie in order because it was not obvious to understand what's going on. Yeah, the movie has only shear deformations, there's never a rotation. And so what we're proposing is delta psi equals zero and delta u at a given axis. And if you know that delta psi is zero, you can express delta phi in terms of delta theta, or delta theta in terms of delta phi. And you can now eliminate delta theta phi, and you can calculate the change of delta phi of the elongation of the circle. And if you get a change delta phi, for delta psi equals zero, you get a non-zero delta theta, which is the triangle orientation which changes. And that sort of leads to a change in the direction in which this head watches.
If we marked on the circumference of the coin, we marked the point, would
yes.
it also rotate, or would it stay?
It would also rotate, yes. So you can, you can also think of this thing being represented by many, many small triangles. Yeah, and then if it's circular, they're all equilateral, like pixels of this image. Yeah, and then this tells you how these whole triangles behave in this system.
Ah, okay, but look, the triangle, it would really rotate with the
That's why by this pattern shows you how sort of things attached to material points, how they behave. Okay, so that's sort of the geometric background for the type of quantities we're looking at. Now let's first, so the following, I will often just look at average quantities for the whole wing blade. because this gives very, very clear signals and data, and because it gives a lot of information about the process. And also the coarse-grained deformation tensor tells us actually how much the tissue stretches and narrows. The macroscopic tissue deformation is captured by the coarse-grained deformation tensor. So here I plot as a function of time, starting for the whole movie from 16 hours to 34, so two quantities which I've introduced so far. One is the tissue shear, and I only plot from this matrix, the 2x2 matrix, the XX component, because we are looking at a process which essentially stretches along the X-axis, and if I average over all the blades, all the rotations average out, and the XY components are negligible. I use an axis which is essentially aligned with this strong elongation of cells. And now I plot this as a cumulative curve. So I integrate over the shear rate, and this gives me sort of absolute shear. And this is then a dimensionless quantity. And the slope of the blue curve is the shear rate of the wing blade. You see how it sort of goes on and slows down a little bit. So that's the overall deformation of the shape of the wing blade, which undergoes shear. The green curve is now the shape measurement of cells averaged over the tissue, and it shows that cells start to elongate. So in a sense, now they have a strong elongation, and now the elongation of the cells relaxes. And interestingly, these two curves are quite different from each other. Right? If you have a simple elastic material in which triangles cannot change their neighborship or cells cannot change their neighborship, as according to what I just said, the shear rate should be dq dt. There's an alpha beta missing here. Sorry for that. So the fact that they're different, so the geometry of the polygons or triangles themselves would imply that these curves are the same. And they can only be different if there are rearrangements, neighbor exchanges, remodeling of the tissue. And you can also think somehow the tissue undergoes a shear, which is something like a flow. It would not be a flow if the two curves were the same. We see that the cells also first elongate as the tissue shears, which looks like an elastic response to deformation. But then somehow the cells relax their shape and become more isotropic. Well, the tissue continues to elongate. Now let's discuss this point that, yeah?
So to which scale do you need the coarse grain to see this overall shape of how heterogeneous is this locally?
I'll come a little bit to that, but you don't have the coarse grain. If you look at small regions, you get the same type of curves, but with more noise. Yeah? And, okay. But also the problem is if you take a small region between the veins, then you have to use a different axis along which to measure it, because otherwise it rotates a little bit. If you take the whole blade, all these different orientations average to one main axis. But we see the same thing in different regions, especially outside of the veins. The veins behave differently.
So just a couple of cells is sufficient?
I think you need more than a couple because it's very noisy otherwise.
Yeah.
Anyway, it depends on what you need sufficient. You get such beautiful data, you need many cells. And if you get fewer cells, it gets more and more noisy. Mm.
But so what I'm getting at is sort of if there's a measure of, let's say, global non-affine motion in here as opposed to the overall strain, like how much of displacements are not in the direction of elongation?
Anyways, we can all quantify this. We can discuss it if you
okay,
want. We can make lots and lots of different plots. I just showed you the simplest things here. So let's discuss the relationship between these two curves. And to do that, let's relate this, what I call cell elongation property, the shape of a cell, to the question of shape of a tissue. And there are two sort of very simple cases which I want to oppose. The first case is the case where cells keep their neighborship relation when the tissue deforms. In this case, the change of cell shape is directly linked to the shape of tissue, the change of tissue shape. And I can directly use this idea that the shear deformation is a change in Q, and that the tissue shear is a dQ dt. In particular, if all cells do the same thing, the average behaves exactly the same as the quantity for an individual cell. However, there's also a second means by which the tissue can change its shape without the cell actually changing its shape. And that is a neighbor exchange, G1 transition. So you can think of as a patch of tissue. I have it elongated to give it a shape, and here I go from an elongation perpendicular to a weaker elongation perpendicular. And here I do the same thing. Tissue is initially has a longer length in this direction, and later it has a longer length in this direction. But in the process from going from here to here, the changed cells are not stretched. And this is possible when we have a remodeling of the connectivity. So if, for example, cells 1 and 3 via this fourfold vertex now come in proximity, and cells 2 and 4, which were neighbors, move apart and are no longer neighbors. And now the idea is, if I now the change of the tissue shape is a deformation of a tissue, which is characterized by the shear tensor V alpha beta. This type of process contributes to a dq dt, and this type of process contributes to tissue shape change in the absence of dq dt, when this cell elongation does not change. And this contribution we call R. So there's a new contribution to tissue deformation, which does not come from cell deformation, but comes from remodeling of the tissue.
Even in the intermediate state, there is no cell elongation also? I mean, like between this state and the second one, when the cells have to change shape, right, to change numbers at some point. So
I'm not saying that this does not involve all the shape changes. I'm saying you don't need shape changes. And if the initial shape and the final shape between two images is the same, this term doesn't contribute from between these images. But in general, you get, of course, a mixture of both.
Yeah.
And if the cells change slightly their shape, you get a contribution here. But what I'm saying is there are two fundamentally different contributions to tissue deformation. Some of the tissue deformation comes from geometry changes of cells, and some of the tissue shape change does not come from geometry change of cells, but it comes, in fact, from topological changes, remodeling, neighborship changes.
That brings another question. That is, so you were saying that you were following tracking the triangles,
yes,
right? And that does change the triangles because it does change the topology. So how do you deal with that? Because since you are tracking the triangles, some will disappear in one way.
Yeah, then we keep track of it. And when it disappears, you remember what is old name, but you don't use it again. The new triangle has a new name. You can keep track of things that get lost and that appear. Also cells. Cells can disappear. Oh, cells can divide, and new cells appear. You get a new label.
But the cell didn't disappear, though. It's just a triangle because the relationship changed.
In any case, you can keep track of all of that. That's the information content of the data.
Okay.
And you have to organize it. And you need it, these sort of things, in order to calculate these questions. Okay, so now here I show you this quantity R. It's defined such that V is the sum of those two Qs, so R is the difference between those two. And this is the contribution to tissue deformation by cell rearrangement, by tissue remodeling.
It's a bit more general question, but I always have hard time in my head. Mm-hmm. Really think this transition that we see, is it a plastic transition, so there is going to be some sort of threshold in elongation to see it? Or is there a time scale that would be a more viscoelastic transition?
I'm not sure which transition you're referring to.
I mean, is it? Shall we consider that the tissue starts to flow and this is more...
I think this type of question I think I will answer later in my talk. Okay. I'm not exactly sure if I understand it, but here I'm only talking about geometry. There's no physics here, only geometry.
Yeah, I know that.
But what do you say then?
More general perspective.
But the more general perspective comes later. So at the first part of my talk, I only talk about geometry. There's nothing else here. But I think it's important to come to the other questions later. Okay, so this is now the red curve. And this is an interesting property because the slope of the red curve is negative while the slope of the Q curve is positive. So this hints at, in fact, you also see that Q has a steeper slope than the blue line, which means while the tissue elongates, cells actually deform even more than the tissue. And this is because the shear by cell rearrangement gets the other way. It has a negative slope. Now here I introduce this quantity R by just taking the difference. That's sort of a cheap way to do it. But there is a more thorough way to do it. And that is one can calculate contributions to tissue deformation from different rearrangement type processes in the tissue directly and separately so that this equation holds. And we can subdivide R in contributions stemming from different types of cellular processes. Cell neighbor exchanges, but also others like subdivision cones and so. So the idea is R is the sum of different contributions. T is the one I just mentioned from neighbor exchanges. C comes from cell divisions, E comes from cell extrusions. Whenever there is a remeshing of this network, triangles leaving or entering, or triangles being changed, this gives an extra contribution to the one that I introduced before, and that's what I call R, and I can call it separately. And just to illustrate you how this works, it works the same for all cases, but it's easiest described in the case of the neighbor exchange. So here I show you a schematic that happens in the neighbor exchange. So these two cells, which are neighbors, are no longer labels here, and two other cells get close. And before the neighbor, so this is a crucial point where somehow it happens, is an instant in time, yeah, at which the topology changes. It's one moment, so there's not a dynamics thing, it's one moment. Before that, we have these two triangles, and after that, we have these two triangles. You see the way I draw it here, the overall outline of my four cells doesn't really change. So at the moment where this thing happens, that suddenly the triangles have to be redefined, there is no tissue shear, there's no tissue rotation. And if I now want to satisfy this equation, what I have to do is I want to make sure that at this moment the tissue does neither shear nor rotate. I switch from triangulation Q minus to triangulation Q plus, which is different. There's a delta Q, must Q minus and Q plus, and the R I have to introduce is sort of at this instant, so it's a delta function in time, Tn is the moment where this happens. At this time, I have to put in a delta Q in this function R, and then I can define this equation and have defined the effect of the remeshing on the tissue deformation. And it makes sure that at this instant, the contribution coming from the change in triangles is balanced by this term so that there's no shear, as it has to be, no rotation.
So there's some evidence that orientation of spindles has some contribution to the elongation. Mm-hmm. Would that be a mechanism that fits within this neighbor exchange sort of bin? Because it contributes to the relative position?
It's certainly a mechanism that affects cell shape. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are a number of mechanisms which affect also cell mechanics and therefore can drive neighbor exchanges. Mm-hmm. But I'm not talking here about the causes of these events. I'm just describing them geometrically.
Okay.
The causes is a separate issue.
So
here I'm building a framework to explain the geometry of whatever happens.
I see. So one could imagine that the spindle orientation part of the system could contribute to either one of these.
Yes.
Okay.
So since in these movies we can keep track of the remeshing events, we have to replace triangles by new triangles, we can have information about the delta Qs, and we can bin this in these different categories, neighbor exchange, cell division, cell extrusion. We can therefore separately calculate different curves corresponding to these different contributions, so that overall the measured tissue deformation comes from a rate of change of some coarse grain elongation tensor plus contributions from rearrangements, which are here shown separately. So this is now the red curve here is now only from T1 transitions. The yellow curve is now only from cell divisions. I did not show here the contributions from extrusions because they're so small. You don't see them, essentially zero. But I highlight here another contribution, which I want to say a few words about, is this purple curve, which contributes to shear in this tissue, and which we call a correlation contribution. And the origin of this contribution comes from this co-rotational time derivative, which is a non-linear operator, and the fact that we are discussing here coarse-grained quantities. So on a single triangle level, you have the exact relationship, so n is a triangle index, that the locally calculated dq dt gives exactly the shear of the triangle. However, if we now define the shear coarse-grained over a region of the tissue, by averaging over the many triangles in the tissue, we get this average shear, and this is now an average of dq dt. And because this is not a normal differential operator, which is linear, but a co-rotational differential operator, the average of dq dt is not the same as ddt of the average of q. So we can write V. So these two things are not the same. So D average QDT plus a correction gives V. And we have to take this correction into account. And this correction is sort of simple because it's just the difference between those two. So it's D is the average of DQDT minus D average QDT. So in a tissue where all the triangles do exactly the same thing, these two averages are the same. Only if triangles do different triangles do different things, if there are fluctuations and homogeneities in the system, are these averages different. And then therefore one can see that this difference is related to fluctuations around the average. So now, because I think that there was the question earlier whether we do the average of Q with an area weight, and I think we do, and that's what creates this first term. There's a correlation between local area contractions and Q, which contributes here. But that from the corotational time derivative, we get also a second contribution of correlations between rotations and Q. And by sort of when I take those two things together and I define by delta omega and delta Q the difference from the average, then this turns out to be just a correlation of fluctuations. So this contribution D is non-zero if fluctuations of rotations of triangles and fluctuations of elongations of shape of triangles are correlated. If all the triangles do the same, this is zero. Yes?
Would I have to worry about this if I just stuck with a deformation tensor as opposed to elongation tensor? Just the loss of degree.
But if you do that, you cannot write this equation here because the superposition needs these definitions I introduce.
Well, the composition is self-inflicted.
But it turns out to be useful later.
I'm suggesting not to.
You suggest not to write an equation. You suggest not to write an equation. I'll need it later. But of course, you can not measure these quantities. It's quantities that one can measure and that have these properties that I've described. Now, in contrast to this type of correlations, which in the particular tissue we're looking at does not give a contribution that is sort of visible, even though there are fluctuations of both area and Q, the second correlation does give a significant contribution, which somehow means that in this tissue, triangle shape changes and tissue rotations are correlated in ways that this average over the blade is non-zero.
Then does it depend on the size of your cross-graining?
It does depend on the size. If you don't cross-grain at all, you don't have this contribution. It's generated by the nonlinearities when you average. It's a little bit like a renormalization effect when you cross-grain a nonlinear system.
Susan, explain this effect, this presence of the correlation in terms of the flow actually being plane shear, which is not uniform.
Yeah, related to the slide. Correct. I have a slide here. Knowing from our analysis that there is a correlation between on small scales between shape changes and rotations, which is not so obvious if you look at it, we then looked at our data. Because this is a correlation function that is interesting to look at. What it means is a different question, it's just a correlation function. And so what we did here is we looked at our subsequent frames, and using the deformation tensor, we can calculate the rotation angles and the rotation rate. And so these are now, for each triangle, for two subsequent images, the rotation angles color-coded for clockwise versus counterclockwise, and the size of the blob tells you how much rotation there is in the deformation field. And what is striking here, that these triangle rotations between these two subsequent frames, and this is sort of very general in this tissue in larger time frames, has these patterns. We think that these patterns are the origin of the fact that there's a correlation of the fluctuations in this tissue, which is not something that every tissue has. It has to do with how triangles fluctuate in the tissue.
Wouldn't you have discovered this pattern just by taking the gradient of the velocity field to observe that there's
this pattern is measured from the gradient of the velocity field, but in order to get this correlation, it's not enough to have the gradient of the velocity field. You also have the, it's correlated actually with shape changes. So the rotations are correlated with shape changes, which is also not a trivial property. Anyways, it's just I'm just reporting here on a correlation. I'm not doing anything more. But one can sort of, if these rotation patterns are related to these correlations I'm mentioning that we see, this corresponds to fluctuations of cells that tend to have rows of cells sliding relative to each other forward and backward as a fluctuation, as an important fluctuation mode in this tissue. But it's hard to answer related questions because I'm not claiming I understand what the purpose of these fluctuations is. I'm just saying, looking at the data, one finds these fluctuations and one finds these correlations. And they are at the origin of having this contribution in the set of quantities that help us to see which type of processes contribute to overall shear by different means. So the logic here is we now have a overall tissue deformation, and we can account for this tissue information as a sum of several contributions. The green curve is a contribution from cell shape changes, and sort of average cell shape changes. The red comes from the neighbor exchanges. The yellow comes from cell divisions, and the purple comes from the fact that the system is also fluctuating, and Q is not homogeneous as it changes. So as you are doing with time, so a little bit of time left. So I have to speed up a little bit. I think I have how much time left? 15 minutes or
about
25. Oh, okay. Good. So far, I have spent some time to explain geometric concepts that are useful here, and that can be used to follow large numbers of polygons and triangles over time and their remodeling. Now I want, based on the information we gained from this analysis, I want now to go to those questions about what is actually going on, what drives the process, what are the physical mechanisms that take place. And I'm using these geometric methods as a tool to address these questions. So in the following, I will not worry about the different contributions, because I want to keep my point of view a bit simple, coarse-grained. So I will summarize all these contributions in this red curve and call it shear induced by rearrangements. And it has different types of detailed causes, which I just mentioned. And let's now look at what these three curves actually mean if you look at the tissue. Now, I can distinguish early and late times. And the early times are the times when the tissue elongates, but the cells all elongate, and somehow the red curve does the opposite. And as I mentioned before, this negative slope allows the green curve to be steeper than the blue curve. Now, what this means is sketched down here. So I have a sketch of a little patch of tissue which is elongated and which elongates more. That's sort of the slope of the blue curve, the elongation of a patch of cells. And as this tissue elongates, neighbor exchanges, which dominate the cell rearrangements, act sort of in opposition. So cell bonds which are along the axis where the tissue elongates, on average, tend to contract and then reopen perpendicularly. And as a consequence, you see, for example, the cells 2 and 4, where this bond contracts, get into proximity, while cells 1 and 3 move apart. So while the tissue stretches here, the cells 2 and 4 are stretched even more in order to get together. And that's what this negative slope means. And the negative slope means that the bonds that contract are on the same axis at which the tissue elongates. So the shear induced by the T1s is opposite in sign to the shear corresponding to the cell shape change. And as a result, the cells elongate more than the tissue, and that's why the green curve is steeper than the blue curve. So in my quantification, this means Vx is positive, Q dot is positive, but R is negative. It's a slope. So this is always cumulative, so the quantities I usually discuss are the slopes of these curves. Now, for this to happen, we need an active process, yeah?
Sorry about bringing up this elongation business. So did you say that as a result of this process, the tissue elongates even more?
I'm just describing geometry right now. I'm not.
Or I don't have a causality. Or did you say that cell shape gets more elongated? That's what I'm...
Yeah, this depends on boundary conditions and so on. So this is not causality for them. What I'm describing is geometry. The quantities are not independent of each other.
So I'm describing some observed geometry. So therefore we can...
So I think the kind of questions you ask, I can answer them later. Here, I'm just describing the geometry of what happens without giving you a cause. I'm not saying this causes that. Okay? I'm just saying that this is a geometric change. The picture I'm sort of... Let me suggest a picture for you, but it's sort of a hypothesis at this moment. This is an active process where the bonds actually contract. And then this contributes to stretching to cells. If in addition the tissue is stretched overall, you get an... So you can get this process with the active T1s. You can get in a situation where the blue curve is zero, the tissue doesn't stretch, or you can get it with a blue curve has a positive slope. But the point is the green curve has a higher slope than the blue curve, whatever the blue slope is. So you can have the same scenario in a tissue where you pull on it and it stretches, or in a tissue which keeps its shape constant. You can still discuss this process. But all these processes are linked geometrically. That's the point of the geometry. One is not independent of the others. So that's sort of the picture which I draw here is that there is an active process which contracts bonds, drives T1 transitions, and as these bonds are contracted in a tense tissue which is even pulled to elongate, this has to have an extra energy source. There's an active process which takes place, as a suggestion here. And this active process helps to deform cells even more than they would given the shape change of the tissue. Now, if you look at later times, the red curve changes sign, and the green curve relaxes, even though the tissue continues to elongate. Now, what this means is now we have now these elongated cells. We have an elongated patch of tissue. The tissue elongates even more, but the cells can now relax their shape and get more isotropic. Those bonds perpendicular contract, and now the bonds horizontal open. So now the T1 transition opens in the direction along with the tissue deformation. And that's why the slopes of the blue and the red are not the same. So now the sign of shear by neighbor exchanges has changed, and therefore when the tissue elongates more, cells relax their shape. These are the two processes that we see in this data. And the second process here can be passive. Now, this can be passive relaxation, but the first process probably is an active driven process. So with these ideas in mind, let me now propose a very simple mechanical model of such a tissue, which can be discussed in various refined or simplified versions. So I'm not building, using this geometric information, having these ideas in mind, I'm now building a model of the mechanics of this remodeling tissue. The basic ideas are that I treat cells as elastic objects. So I write down an elastic relationship for relating local stress and shape of cells. And I also have an extra term, which either is an active contribution to the stress generated by active force-generating processes in the cell, or can be seen as a spontaneous tendency of a cell to have a non-isotropic shape. This is not really resolved by this equation. It's the same equation for both cases. So if the cell is isotropic, then there's a stress, shear stress, even in the absence of Q. That's what this term describes. Or if you say that you take the cell in isolation without external stresses, then Q is set by this term zeta, which I call an active stress. There's an active deformation of the cell in the reference state without stress. And this is a Hooke's law. K is an elastic modulus of a cell for deformations. And I didn't write here on the slide also the corresponding Hooke's law for cell area in two dimensions. So I treat the cell as an elastic object with two elastic moduli. Now we have this geometric relation. And of course, this is a state quantity, so we need the state quantity Q, which determines stress. Now we have this relationship that I explained in length about the geometry. The tissue deformation rate is a sum of a rate of change of cell properties plus something that comes from cell rearrangements, R. Now, the quantity dQ dt, if we know that Q is a measurable quantity, this is just the time derivative of an observable in our problem. So Q is an important order parameter, and you can say in this model. The only thing that we're really lacking now is a theory for R. And that's the shear contribution by cell rearrangements. And what I'm going to describe here is a very simple-minded ansatz, for simplicity just treating it linear. Of course, in reality, it will be nonlinear. And since it's a very complex process that gives rise to cell rearrangements and associated shear, I write the most general possible linear relationship, which has a memory kernel. So the function R depends somehow on the history of cell states. Cell states are characterized by Q as a function of time. And if we take the contribution of all possible states in the past into account, this is done with an integral, and chi is now the so-called memory kernel, which describes a very complex dynamic process which has memory in the past, and this contains all the complexities of the process, which we don't know the function, but if we know it, we have a model. And then finally, we have a force balance equation. So the total stress, this also includes the two-dimensional isotropics part, has to be force balanced, and because the tissue is in context to a cuticle, as I mentioned before, there's also friction terms when the cells move relative to the cuticle. So we also have to use a friction coefficient here.
Can you remind us how V-twiddle related to V?
So V-twiddle is the shear part of the velocity gradient. So it's the traceless symmetric part of the velocity gradient.
So therefore, from force balance, I know velocity, I can differentiate it and yes, symmetrize, subtract the trace. And so the left-hand side, I know from
So if I write this equation together with force balance, I get effectively differential equations, partial differential equations for the time dependence of V and the time dependence of Q. And then I have a sort of hydrodynamic or continuum mechanical description, which describes both cell shapes.
So V hat is the time derivative of V twiddle is V. I'm missing.
No, V twiddle is the traceless symmetric part of V, of the velocity gradient.
Correct. So therefore, I'm still trying to understand.
Yeah, this light doesn't give you the final equations.
Yeah. So you know the left-hand side, and you have a model for the right-hand side, and you want to compute the time derivative of Q because you don't know it otherwise.
So you can write this together with boundary conditions and the force balance equation. You obtain differential equations for the velocity and for Q. And it's a dynamic problem. It turns out that because of this error term, it becomes a viscoelastic type system. I'll show it in a moment. And so it's like hydrodynamics, mechanics of a very complex viscoelastic system with very complex rheology, which you can solve sort of with standard methods if you know the boundary conditions. But it's a continuum mechanical problem that is uniquely defined. And I just sketch here the defining equations. I don't show you how to do it. But it's equivalent to a continuum mechanical problem that has a unique solution. But the solution is not only V, it's also Q. Q is the unknown. So the cell shape as a function of time is part of the solution.
You also add incompressibility to eliminate the pressure? Or what do you assume to...
I didn't write it down here. We are using also an area elasticity. So there's a Hooke's law for area changes. And there's a preferred area. And if cells divide, you can take into account that this area becomes smaller, things like that. I didn't write this down here, but this is all...
It's slightly compressible.
It is compressible, yeah. There's a modulus, and you can make it small or big as you want. Okay. Now, the big unknown, so I think most of these elements here are sort of more or less straightforward. Elastic cells, also this geometric relation is quite straightforward. Force balance. The only thing that is completely unknown is this equation. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, we can find a lot of information about this memory from our data, what I want to show you now. That's essentially the big unknown of the model. All the rest is quite
May I ask another question?
Yes.
What kind of active stresses and active processes do you put in? What kind of active stresses and processes go into your model?
This model doesn't say exactly what it is. It's sort of a constrained picture. This is an active process, which would not dare be there in a passive system. This is an active process, but would not be there in a passive system, because cells have stress fibers and can generate contractions in an anisotropic way.
So, but it's a tensor, so you put just random tensor elements, or you put
no expansion compression. What we need to understand the particular system I'm talking about, we need spatially organized active stresses, which means there's some PCP system oriented as active stresses, and you could try to speculate about what it exactly is. At this level, I don't know what is the biological cause of these terms. I'm just telling you that they somehow exist, and then the next question would be exactly what process causes it. I will not give the answer to that today. But I show you evidence that they exist. Mm-hmm. So this is the big equation that we like to understand, and this is a memory effect, which means that the shear due to cell rearrangements somehow is driven either actively or by cell state, but with a delay, with this memory kernel. And to understand this memory kernel, we can just look at the data and plot R versus Q over time. And this is what's shown here, RXX, QXX, the data for the ring. And the colors are the different time points. So we start at 16 hours in the red part, and then as the time evolves, this moves in time. And now this is a non-trivial property, but it turns out that we can perfectly explain the data with a very simple choice of this memory kernel. So this black curve corresponds to a very simple memory kernel, which is a single exponential relaxation process. So I'm choosing a memory kernel with a delay time tau d. That's sort of the memory effect in this kernel. And then there's a prefactor, and it turns out that there are two timescales. So the tau d is the same as here. We can get it from the exponent. But as a second time scale, this comes from the units. Q is dimensionless, R is a rate, and you have an extra time integral. And so there's an extra time tau, which you also extract from this fit. And one of these times, as I mentioned, is a delay time, how long it takes from the cell state to actually have an effect on the shear rate in the tissue. The other one is sort of the classical maximal relaxation time of a classical fluid. So if we wouldn't have a memory effect, but just the direct instantaneous relation between R and Q here, we would get a maximal model of a viscoelastic material. So this memory kernel is more complex than a simple viscoelastic material. It's a more complex rheology. But it's this rheology we can see in this data. Now, these are the fit values. So the maximal time that corresponds is about 2 hours. This delay time is about 4.2 hours. And we also can fit the contribution of this active term. And since this is a rate, this is also a rate. This has negative sign because I said it drives T1 transition in the perpendicular direction as compared to the extension of the tissue, and has units of times as minus 0.1 per hour. Now, the time is almost up. Let me just make a couple of final remarks. Now, if we take this model with this memory kernel, now this defines us now a relationship between the shear due to cell rearrangements and cell states. And this now defines fully a mechanical model. Now we have the model defined with this chi. If I combine this equation with the geometric relation between velocity, dq, dt, and r, and then I can eliminate r, and I get effectively a relationship between velocity, the shear rate, and the cell elongation. And you can think of q as a cell state variable, which can also be replaced by cell stress. So if you load local stress, we can then relate it to shear rate. So this is by eliminating R from these two equations, we get the equations which define the material properties, stress versus strain rate. If this memory kernel had no memory but was instantaneous, we would get the classical Maxwell model properties. This is more complex. Let me show you how it's more complex. Since this is a linear system, if we forget about co-rotations, because we don't have rotations in the simple picture, everything is along the x-axis. It's linear, and then this rheological equation gives rise to linear relaxation processes whenever we do a step change. For example, if you do a step change in shear rate, we start in a model with zero shear rate, and suddenly there's a constant slope, which is a finite shear rate. A step change in shear rate will induce a perturbation, and the linear model will relax to a new steady state, and the characteristic relaxation time is linear. And this characteristic relaxation time, S, because of this extra memory, turns out to be a complex number. So there are damped oscillations here. So it's not like an ordinary Maxwell fluid, it's different. So there's an imaginary part and a real part. And so the relaxation is shown in the green curve, there's a cell shape. The cell shape shows a damped oscillation response in this model. And this looks qualitatively a little bit like what we see in the actual tissue. So this is a hint at what happens with this behavior of the cell shape in the tissue. It's related to a damped oscillation in this complex rheology. Now, the difference between those two is essentially that because I didn't put in this simple example here the active contribution, I put it to zero just to make this most simple version of the model. The blue and green curves start out with the same slope. In the experiment, they have different slopes. If I now add the negative active term, I get also this red curve which starts with negative slope. The two are different. So now I have the same qualitative behavior. So this explains, this rheology explains qualitatively the behavior that we see of cell shape in the tissue as a function of time. And the suggestion is that what we see this increase and this relaxation is in fact a damped oscillation in a tissue with a very unusual rheology. And now just to finish, maybe do it a little bit faster because time is almost up. This is just very qualitative. In order to get a quantitative comparison between this mechanical picture and an actual tissue dynamics, we have to solve these differential equations and we have to take into account boundary conditions as a partial differential equation problem subject to boundary conditions. And so we are doing this. In particular, Marco, who is here, has worked on these differential equations in two dimensions. Here I will just show you a very simple-minded approach that helps us to compare to experimental data. By solving a simple problem that is easy calculated, can be compared to the data, we take two rectangles and we treat each rectangle as homogeneous to describing the average properties of this piece of tissue. We allow the hinge and the blade to have different properties. We introduce parameters describing elastic linkers at the periphery. The hinge has the property that it tends to contract, because that's what happens. And therefore, the parameters are different for the two tissues. And with this model, we can create, when we solve it, time-dependent functions for the overall shape change of the tissue. We're looking at the blade, for the shape change of cells in the tissue, that's the green curve, and for the shear induced by topological changes. And we can choose parameters so that these match, so we can fit the model to the data and then determine these model parameters from the experiment. And here I sketch what this looks like. So this is our little rectangle model superimposed to the movie of the fly wing. And this shows how the model describes cell shapes at a given time point. And so this model accounts for all these three curves, for the average behavior of the whole tissue. And now the interesting point, sort of I finish with that, maybe 1 or 2 minutes, is now to come back to the dumpy mutant, which I do very quickly now. I guess Suzanne has explained this already. But if we now see what is different, what has changed in dumpy mutant, because we can watch it in the pupa, and we see that it does behave very differently from the wild type, exactly at this time in pupil development. And a big difference is the motion of the margin. So what this hints at is that the dumpy mutant, which is an extracellular matrix-associated protein, changes the mechanical boundary condition, in some changes the pattern of boundary conditions, in particular at the distal end. Suddenly, these elastic linkers either break, are lost, or are just very soft. The dumpy is particularly found in these marginal regions. And sort of in our model, we keep all the tissue parameters the same as in wild type, and we only allow properties to change that are associated with connection of the tissue to the outside world, either elastic linker parameters at a margin or friction coefficients between tissue and cuticle, which could also be affected by the extracellular matrix. And now we can only change these parameters, we can also account for the dumpy mutant, the same mechanical model. And this suggests to us that this wing is shaped by an active mechanical process. The active mechanics comes both from contraction of a part of the tissue, in particular the hinge, as well as the active T1 transitions, which I mentioned, which drive neighbor exchanges. It is guided by mechanical boundary conditions with the help of the accelerator matrix, And mechanical perturbations can modulate the mechanics of the boundary conditions and thereby induce changes of the tissue shape of the adult. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your time.
Time for a few questions.
Okay. One of the things that confused me was this memory function. Can you give us a little rationalization of it? Felt like you just pulled that out of thin air because it means your model worked. I understand. What's the justification?
I guess the justification is that R is a complex process that happens beyond the cell scale. So it has to do with the neighbor exchange, so bonds have to shrink, cells have to form new contacts, remove old contacts. So this is a very complex cellular process which involves lots of cell biology. And we don't know exactly what are the rules that guide this process. And what this function is, it is sort of a general function which somehow contains all these rules, which we don't know. So the idea here is rather than sort of starting from the cell biology up and trying to find out what these rules are and calculating this function from a small scale, which I wouldn't know how to do, we're looking at the data and trying to determine what it actually is. And now in the next step, one can try to understand better what is the underlying cell biological cause that generates this function.
What is the dynamism? What is the
delay? The delay is, where was it?
4 hours?
That was 4 hours, 1 or 2 hours, yeah. And the whole process is 17 hours.
Do we have material in nature which have the same passive mechanical behavior, taking out the active part?
That's a good question. I think Marco has thought about it a lot. Here, do you know?
I mean, if you want to make a biological network that has this response, you need to introduce an element called inertor, which has effectively inertial response, which would probably represent some internal chemical network or something. It has been recently used in Formula One suspensions. This is maybe interesting. You can also...
So it's engineering, I think.
Yeah, it was recently used a lot to improve the response of
So you can do it passively, but you need an element which is called an inertor, which has behaves a little bit like a mass, but it is in somewhat unusual ways. It's like a... Yes?
I wonder, in fitting the model to the data, do you have any time-dependent fitted quantities, or are all of your fitted quantities constant in time?
We keep everything constant in time. Mm-hmm. So of course there are time-dependent processes in this wing, but we're trying to have a very minimal model for the average behaviors, and so we are trying to, in some sense, all the parameters are averaged over time, and then we keep them constant. We're not trying to, but I think the next step is to really solve these partial differential equations, two dimensions, and try to understand what is the time dependence and what are the spatial patterns. And it's something also Marco is involved with.
So, the transition between the two sort of phases that you look like happens at about 22 hours, mm-hmm. PM,
yeah.
Are there any biological or physiological gene activity events that happen to coincide with that time that you suspect could be involved in the transition?
Not that I'm aware of, but it's an interesting yeah. question, but I don't think that we
that's sort of
much
a prediction,
that.
Perhaps, yeah. that this might suggest that something...
Yeah, but with our model, you don't need that. Yeah, we keep everything in constant time, that's what happens. Yeah. Of course, you could also think of some more choreography in time, but yeah. The model I present can do it without this temporal choreography. It's just an event that happens from the rules that I... But the memory is important, yeah. So one could probably replace the memory by some choreography.
It will happen at some point, yeah. I see.
Is there a question back?
Yeah. So you characterize this shear rate by cellular rearrangements, and you found a relation to T1 transitions, which you assumed are delta functions over time. Now, in reality, you see that T1 transitions can be a rather long event. At least in fruit fly embryos, you see that they can be like 30 minutes or so. Mm-hmm. Now, in the wing, how long would it take to make a T1 transition, and how does that relate to your delay time that you have in your kernel? And could you find some relations between them?
I think usually the T1s happen between frames, and you,
Yeah, but they oscillate back and forth, right? So sometimes you have the A cell neighboring the B cell, and sometimes it doesn't, right? And then it, so it's a longer process when you look finer.
Yeah, when they oscillate, they average away in our contribution to shear. Yeah? In that sense, this is a fluctuation which gets averaged out in the process. And usually we see the T1s between frames, and those that really contribute to shear, you go through between two frames of 5 minutes as compared to 2 hours. But it's an interesting point, because if you have if you stay for a long time in a four-fold vertex, then one has to rethink about how to write the contribution to shear. It gets a little bit more subtle.
Well, I was wondering whether this memory thingy, you are thinking about it in terms of PCB. So, you know, when the cell is deforming, what is going to see, what transitions,
yes.
And so on, what changes in, we need to change in the anisotropies of the cell is the positioning of the molecules in the PCB. Is this what you're thinking?
I didn't want to commit here, but of course, this is due to PCP. Now, this is a set of things. So it is certainly reorganizing PCP during the remodeling. That's certainly part of the time you have to wait. But you have also, if you create a new bond, or if you remove a bond, you have to shuttle molecules. These processes take for the contributory delay. So I think there are lots of cell biological processes which contribute, but PCP is one of them.
Because when I was thinking about this, then, yeah. You know, okay, this is a complex phenomenon, the PCP, but one of the phenomena is the K-on-K-off of those molecules.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
And when one does frap on them, the time scale is not in the order of 4.2 or 1.7, now it's much shorter.
Yes.
Then there must be something which is that it's not the K-on-K-off.
But it's an emergent phenomenon. This property here is on at least two cell level. So within a cell you see faster events, and these many fast events they collectively contribute to something slower happening between cells. That's the picture. And I think there's a complex relation between this and the real molecular contributions. And I think I don't have an explanation. But I think this essay provides interesting quantities to try to understand. Because it's a dynamic and rheological property of a tissue, which is different from normal materials, and we don't have an explanation for it right now. But it's a question that is asked by using this approach.
So, in the lamping metals, you have a strange crystal pattern in the interior of the lamp. Do you have each type of defects of the boundary formation in the surroundings?
I'm not sure. I would have to. I don't know about. But I could say that in the dumping mutant, also there are many different dumping mutants, and many are lethal. The one I show here is sort of a more mild one. But in this, you see that the initial state, this answers your question partly, the initial state at 16 hours APF, you can essentially not distinguish the mutant from the wild type. All the change is really, the dramatic change happens later. So there's not much difference here. And I suspect there's not much difference earlier, but I don't know.
So in linear response, usually, correct me if I'm wrong, but usually the memory kernel is related to some fluctuation, right?
In equilibrium systems, yeah.
Right. In this case, can we kind of find a fluctuation that corresponds to this memory kernel?
Yes. These are sort of the type of fluctuation which I just mentioned, the T1 transition fluctuations, and going forward, backward through the T1 transition. That would be the corresponding fluctuation.
Do you think this is...
But since we're averaging over those, we don't have a model for those. And the next step would be not only have a model for R, but also for the variable fluctuations of R. And that's the ones that you're talking about, and can measure them,
right.
As you pointed out. But we don't treat them here.
I'm going to draw the discussion to a close now. So thank you very much, Frank.